Welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with the movers, the shakers, the film and TV makers, the producers, the directors, the writers, the actors, the cinematographers, the film editors, the sound editors, sound mixers, costume designers, production designers, VFX gurus, composers, award winners, award nominees, and so much more. Very excited for today's show. First of all, because we're going to have director R.J. Collins joining us at the midpoint of the show to talk about his new film, Crescent City. And that is a day-date release this week on August 16th. It is a crime thriller. It will keep you guessing to the bitter end. It's about a serial killer. And it is very so well constructed, directed by RJ, written by Rich Ronat, who is a frequent collaborator with RJ. And it stars Terrence Howard, Isai Morales, Nikki Whelan, Alec Baldwin. And it will have it twists and turns galore. I really like this film. From the performances, from the story structure, to the production values. It's a goodie. So I can't wait to talk to RJ about this one when he joins us. But in a moment, you're going to hear my exclusive interview with Emmy nominee composer Blake Neely, who is nominated for an Emmy Award for the main theme. He also did the score of the entire series, but he's nominated for the main theme, Masters of the Air. Now, anybody that has listened to the show, has checked out my website, you know I am a huge fan of Masters of the Air. I love that series, which is streaming on Apple TV. So if you haven't seen it, I encourage you to check it out. But one of the great elements of Masters of the Air is that opening main theme title sequence at the beginning of every episode. Absolutely stunning. And Blake and I dove in to this just last week. We chatted. And he was my last Emmy nominee because that I've interviewed. You've got a plenty more that are popping up on BehindTheLensOnline.net and probably next week here on Behind the Lens on Adrenaline Radio. But it is so incredibly crafted from a musical standpoint and a thematic standpoint. And the way that Blake uses instrumentation, and anybody that knows me knows how much I love breaking down score, how much I love breaking down the music. Brian Tyler is a big reason why. I love Brian's work, but so many other composers over the years that I have known, that I have watched work, that I've spoken with, going all the way back to Joe Gershenson, who is a legend in classic film. And he was a dear, dear friend, and he actually was a composer and conductor and arranger at Universal for many, many years, working on films like Irma LaDuce, some Doris Day films. I learned so much from Joe, especially when he took me into the orchestra room, and I got to watch him conducting. And he was explaining things to me. And this is going back, you know, 40 years. But I learned so much from him. And then over the years, other composers I've learned a lot from, especially Brian, Aaron Zygman, and many others. So I love chatting with composers, especially for something as wonderful as what Blake has done for Masters of the Air. Because as you listen to the opening of every show, musically, he takes us from, and this is where the instrumentation is so important with the, within the score itself. He opens with an oboe, then slowly takes us into French horns, It's very slow. It's very languid. For the oboe, we're seeing some of the men visually. When the French horn comes in, we start seeing the planes prepping for what's to come. It's very slow. It's very languid. Slowly, strings come up in the arrangement behind the brass. And then when the planes hit the air and they're soaring above the clouds, full orchestral movement comes in. The music is sweeping. It dives and leaps within the melody itself, equating to the movements of the planes, and eventually brings in a choir with the full orchestral. So by the time we get to the end of the opening title and theme, it's the ebullience of the war ending. And so in that short 2 minute opening, or 2.5 minute opening, Blake musically gives us the arc of the entire series. And as you'll hear him talk about, one of the great things for him, and it is a luxury, it doesn't happen often, is the visuals were cut and put together to the music versus the other way around, where you're given, here's the visual opening, composed to it. So that was a real luxury and a real treat for Blake. Just an incredible guy. He's so enthusiastic. He loves scoring so much. But I don't know. He keeps diving into these military and plane scores and title themes. You know, he's done Greyhound. He's done Goodnight Opie. He's done The Pacific, Band of Brothers, The Flight Attendant. He's also done some rom-coms, like First Daughter and The Wedding Date. But that was long ago, before he got into this military and plane kind of deja arc that he's been doing for a number of years now. 22 years composing for picture. And I hope he'll be here for another 22. But without any further ado, I'm going to let you take a listen to my exclusive interview with composer Blake Neely, nominated for Outstanding Original Main Title Theme Music for Masters of the Air. And oh, who is he up against? Jeff Toyne for Palm Royale. Just kill me. Just kill me now. Because I love both. But I think in the main title theme, my heart lies with Blake and Masters of the Air. So take a listen.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Blake. How are you?
I'm good. Nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you. I have long been an admirer of your work. And
oh, you're sweet. Thank you.
To hear what you have done with Masters of the Air, I don't care how many times I watch the series, which I have binged several times already, but it's one of the few series that instead of skipping the intro, I always listen to that main title theme. It takes me on an emotional roller coaster, starting out softly as we're the visuals are showing us prepping to go up in the air, the guys meeting the guys, and your instrumentation is so perfect. And then slowly, once we get up into, it's slow and languid, some bass in there, maybe from a trombone or trumpet. And then your score just opens up. The main title theme just opens up once they get in the air, and it goes full orchestral. And it just gives me goosebumps every time I hear it.
Oh, thank you so much. Can you be my PR agent forever?
Of course. Happy to.
I mean, what a beautiful understanding of what I tried to do, which is start slow and not somber, just, reverent.
Yes.
And then my biggest struggle with creating the main title was, how do I literally make it soar and feel like flying? And that was my whole goal, so for you to have put it just like that, thank you so much for understanding.
It truly soars. That is the word for it. And something very key, and so much of this is the instrumentation.
You did not just sit down, put notes on the page, and play them on a piano. This is full orchestral instrumentation, with each instrument playing a very significant part in the emotional tone of this theme.
Yep. I explained to someone the other day that I always wanted to write the main title as something, you know, a simple tune that you could play on any instrument, but I wanted to then overproduce it and pack it with enough in the orchestra that it's kind of impossible to pull off without all of that instrumentation.
The way that you have balanced, you know, I don't know if the very first instrument we hear is a clarinet, maybe?
It starts with an oboe, yeah.
Okay, an oboe.
Which is my tribute to Michael Kamen, who...
he was your mentor!
And he was my mentor, and we did Band of Brothers together. Well, I orchestrated on Band of Brothers, and he was an oboe player, so that was my salute to him, and it starts and ends with an oboe, and so that's why I chose that. Also, it's one of the most emotional, inviting, sort of pull-you-in instruments.
Yes. I played the oboe in elementary school for a number of years.
Oh, wow.
I was never very good at it. I was passable.
Did you spend most of your nights making reeds?
No. Back then in the 1960s, we just had to buy them. And I went through more reeds. You don't even want to know.
I don't. I have so many friends that just waste their nights making reeds.
In today's day and age, were I still playing it, I probably would be doing that too. Because even in the 60s, reeds were not cheap.
No.
So I love how that, and then you bring in the brass. And as I said, I don't know if it's a bass trombone or a trumpet, but it has that military sound to it that we so often hear during taps.
The French horns have always been heroic to me. That was the instrument I played when I was little, and I, like you, gave it up. But then you got to have the strings to make it come alive. So really, really fun to write. And I feel like Masters was one of these series that I'd kind of been rehearsing my whole career for, because it just came so... It feels like it was effortless. It wasn't. It was a struggle to find it, but it was just such a pleasure to score that whole series bottom.
The whole thing is just, every moment of music is so beautiful. But I love how you balanced the brass with the strings behind it, and then slowly, once we get up into the air, you start bringing the strings up and moving the brass, the French horn, into the background. It really, it shows a shift in the story dynamic as they're moving ahead. This main title encompasses, in a short amount of time, the lay of the entire series.
Yeah, that's one of the things that Gary Getzman said, is they were struggling to find tone, and he, it was such a nice compliment. He said to me that once I sent him my demo for the main title, he's like, oh, I think that's the tone. That's what we're going for. And then I wrote it first because I thought it was an important enough piece that it would give me direction for the rest of it. I mean, although it gets super dark and tragic and super hopeful, all of the series and all of the score, it was always this sort of guiding light of let's not do less than and let's not do more than that main title.
Just exquisitely done, Blake. And I like how what you have come up with in the main title, as well as in the score, everything, there's dignity, you feel the dignity, you hear the dignity, the honor, the camaraderie, the loss, we feel it with the music, but we also capture the adventure of this mission. Something like this had never been undertaken before. And emotionally, we soar with your music. And
oh, thank you so much. You know what's crazy about the main title for me, crazy great, is it's now transcended the show in that the Royal Air Force Band, the United States Marine Corps, and the U.S. Air Force Band have all done arrangements of the Masters of the Air theme and are touring with it. So it truly becomes what it was written for, which is for the men and women and veterans.
And at the same time, you have not glorified war.
That's something I learned very specifically from Michael when he was doing Band of Brothers is you music can and will, if used incorrectly, glorify the situation.
Yeah.
And it was always a, you know, we need music to illustrate this happening, but we cannot glorify what's happening. Down to choices of instrumentation, too. I remember it was like, we can't use trumpets here. They're too fanfare in this battle. We need to, you know, make it less. This is not a glorified thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm really curious here, because how much of the series did you see before you started writing? Because you do encompass the emotion of the and the action of the entire series.
Well, the beautiful thing about a streaming show is, since it's not aired every single week, I got to see all 9 episodes in a rough form before I started, and it was imperative for me writing it because I needed to see the entire story. And I could read about it, but these guys specifically, these men of the 100th. So I did have the pleasure of watching the whole thing. It changed dramatically in form and in scenes and edits, but basically it was all there. So that was very helpful.
Now, did they cut the opening titles to your music, or was you...
They did. They did.
Which wow!
That's a rarity for me, that they cut to it, and so the music got to be what it is without having to, you know, try to chase a cut, which was really nice. And we worked... They did such a beautiful job with the graphics, and everything's just in perfect sync with, you know, the dives and leaps that the music takes. So thrilled with it.
Oh, my God. And that's why I asked the question, because typically it's the other way around.
It is definitely the other way around.
This explains why the imagery is so perfectly in alignment with the music, with the instrumentation. That blows my mind, Blake. You're one lucky boy.
I was very lucky that I got to writing before they could get to designing the main title.
Because I know I hear bits and pieces from the main theme, you know, throughout the series. Some motifs pop up here and there along with everything else. All the other character motifs and all that you're developing throughout the 9 episodes. The main title it's very linear as we go from the beginning and we follow through to the ebullience and joy at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
Did you write in a linear fashion of the story, or did you write bits and pieces and then put them together in a linear fashion?
No, that piece was written linearly. I literally wrote it on my piano and in my living room one night after struggling for weeks to find it. And then that was the piece. And then what's interesting is in the score, we were very careful not to always use that main title, because it was one of those things you're going to hear it every week at the beginning. It's
yep.
a very long main title
mm-hmm.
for television these days, 2.5 minutes. And so we didn't want there to be theme fatigue. So there's the occasion, maybe once an episode, sometimes none an episode, where I would put it in as the sort of here we go moments.
Mm-hmm.
Other times I had all these other themes that we were using, such as I had a theme about going home, which is used at the end titles, and that would come back several times. There was a sorrow theme. There was a tragic theme. There was war theme. There was a cheerleading kind of theme. So I turned all those. I chose not to do character themes because I viewed them as just this one unit working together.
Just amazing. So how excited were you to find out you got an Emmy nomination for this?
Oh, my gosh. I was beyond. I had forgotten that the nominations were happening that day, and my manager texted me. He said, get online. And I was absolutely thrilled because I'm very proud of it, and it still makes me emotional. I've gotten to perform it a few times, which is fantastic, and so I'm just so happy.
How long did it take you not just to write this theme, but also to develop the instrumentation and those spot-on points where it would be changing and what you would be adding?
I would say that the writing of it, just to find those notes, took a long time. I wasn't happy with anything I was coming up with. And then just one night, it came to me. I started playing on my piano. I have a little voice memo on my phone. That took a few hours, and then the development of the orchestration and how it was going to be presented and how it escalates and how much, that was a couple of weeks. It was, you know, that's not a quick process. Very enjoyable process.
Did you get to conduct the orchestra?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, it was great. And then I had about 6 months total on the entire series, which is luxurious for television. To have 6 months to write all of that, and we would record it in batches. We'd say record 4 episodes and then another 3 episodes and another 2 episodes. So we would have time to go back if something wasn't right and do it again. So
wow.
that was true luxury for me scoring.
Yeah, I know. I've interviewed and spoken with so many composers, and I know so many, and the biggest problem that they all say is they are brought in so close to when the score, the music has to be done. It's a challenge. What would you say was the greatest challenge with creating the score and this main title theme for Masters of the Air?
My greatest challenge was that we, you know, I do so much fiction, and this is basically a documentary that is acted out.
Yeah.
And so the biggest challenge was the responsibility of representing these men and women and getting the tone right. Because, and that's where it is so helpful. You know, I'm not just writing an album. I have collaborators. I have the 3 producers. I have all these people, the editors, everyone, you know, who you can bounce it off of, because you don't want to go too big and you don't want to go too small. It's just writing that line and finding the right tone. As you said, not glorifying war, but honoring it. And so those are my 2 biggest challenges, is getting the tone right and honoring our vets.
What is the most gratifying aspect of this experience with Masters of the Air?
That I got to do this one myself, because it was the most gratifying, because I loved doing the Pacific, and I love Jeff and Hans, and I loved being a part of, you know, a small part of Band of Brothers, but it was so gratifying to be able to finish this off and to be the one person on the music team that had a through line through all 3 of them. That was fantastic for me.
What is this about you and military movies, Blake? This seems to be your bailiwick.
What is it with you and airplanes? The flight attendant Pan Am, but I'll take it, because it I love them. But maybe I won't go to war in the next project. Maybe we'll spend some time in peace.
Or a comedy or something.
A comedy would be great.
Because you do. You have done some... It's like, I love the score that you did for Goodnight, Opie.
Oh, you saw that. That's a great project.
Oh, my God. I did indeed see that. And even something like The Time Traveler's Wife is so... Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. But when I listen...
I really love that series. It got buried, but I love that series. I mean, those are the lush orchestral ones. But you know, to be able to have a career that allows me to do such projects like The Flight Attendant, which is just this weird percussion jazz score, and also airplanes. that's a great thing, because I'm never bored. I'm like, well, what am I doing next? What can I shift to?
Were you given any limitations or restrictions from the powers that be on Masters of the Air?
No, actually not. Actually not. It was, we have everything from a single piano to a choir used in this thing. I've worked with Playtone for 19 years now, which is crazy. And we just have such a wonderful relationship that they say, you know, go do your thing, and we'll be here to give you feedback.
Wow. And yes.
It's been an amazing partnership.
And you mentioned the choir. That choir, that orchestral choir coming in, absolutely breathtaking from a sonic and emotional level. Because there it is, that really completes the soaring through the air as all the planes are going through the clouds. Just heavenly. That's the metaphor for it. Heavenly.
Sometimes, even though you have 100 people playing in the orchestra, you just run out of instruments. And it was, I needed the last refrain to just really go, and I thought, well, let's add voices. And it you know, voices are, they're so beautiful, but they also humanize more than anything.
Yes.
So be able to put that stamp on it at the end. Yeah, very, very proud, very happy.
So now, are we ever going to get to hear, like, in a soundtrack format, all 5.5, all 9 episodes of music?
Well, we are talking to Apple about doing so because the series was such a success. It'll be, you know, like every piece of music on probably 3 different albums, but that would be really nice to have out there for a collector's sake.
I would sit and listen to that. Just put it on and keep it running.
You're the best. You'd be a little depressed after a few of them, but you're the best.
Blake, this has been such a joy speaking with you. This is one of my favorites. My 2 favorite series this year are Masters of the Air and Palm Royale. You can't get more different than that. But
no. Well, tell Jeff I said hi when you interview him.
I've interviewed him already.
Oh, great. Okay.
You're the last composer, the last one I'm talking to for Emmy season.
Okay. It's an honor to talk to you, and thank you so much for knowing what I do and understanding it.
Blake, thank you so much, and I can't wait to hear what you bring us next.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Blake.
And that was composer Blake Neely, nominated for Outstanding Original Main Title Theme Music for Masters of the Air. It truly is exquisite. And the way that the music captures the emotional essence of the story, and then using the different instruments to create a unique sound and identifying emotion, and then incorporating choir and orchestral, full-blown, sweeping orchestral movement. It's just, it adds depth and complexity, and it is just beautiful and truly captures the emotion and the tone of the entire series of Masters of the Air. Fingers crossed, as much as I love Jeff Toyne and Palm Royale, I'll be happy if either Jeff or Blake picks up the Emmy win. But my heart leans towards Blake and Masters of the Air as Emmy gold. So we'll find out. Emmy voting starts later this week. So all you Television Academy members, get ready. And as I said, I've interviewed plenty more nominees, and some of those interviews have started trickling up on BehindTheLensOnline.net. The rest will be up, including Palm Royale, hair, makeup, main title design, Silo main title design, all nominated. So those will all be up before voting starts on whatever day the 15th is. What day is the 15th? On Thursday. So stay tuned and check out BehindTheLensOnline.net. And now, we're going to switch gears here. And by the way, if you haven't seen Masters of the Air, and even if you have, watch it again, because it is spectacular. And now, yes, we are. We're switching gears and welcoming the wonderful RJ Collins to the show. Hi, RJ.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Well, you know, we're doing great. We're releasing this week. We're really excited.
Well, you should be, because this is a heck of a thriller.
well, thank you.
You kept me on my toes through this entire film. And serial killer, everybody is a suspect. There's ambiguity everywhere. Just when you think you figured it out, this is a red herring pulling the rug out from under us, sending us down another path. What Rich Rona, your writer and yourself, and I know you and Rich have worked before together before. What a collaboration to bring this to life. Where did the idea for this start with? Did Rich come up with it first, bring it to you? Did the two of you put your heads together and say, hey, this would be really creepy and cool?
Yeah, so Rich, yeah, we have a long working history together. And we were in 2019. He was doing research on, because he just does this for everything. He was doing his research on serial killers, and he found out, like, the little things that they did, how they lure their victim in, how they would kill them, what kind of the reasons were for some of them. Some of them didn't have reasons. And through public domain of so many different killings, he found some very disturbing and fascinating stories that we were like, oh, gosh, we have to tell this we have to turn this into a film. And so we wanted to tell this story. You know, it's even myself, I was captured in these 90s thrillers. They just sucked me in, and you know, it's so wrong, but you just love to watch them because they're, you know, in your head, there's no way this can be real. And it's scary that these things really do happen.
Yeah.
So when you have a little bit of truth within it, with phenomenal writing and great cast, you get to get these kind of movies. And this movie is definitely an homage to the 90s thrillers out there that we grew up loving.
I mean,
I might be aging myself there, but you know.
Ha. You're not aging yourself. I go back a lot further than you. But this is truly a detective story. We are there every step of the way on the investigation into these serial killings and these bodies that are popping up and bodies that are missing. And you really dig into, from a story and dialogue standpoint, but also a visual standpoint, you really establish the tone and you visually capture the minutiae that you just mentioned about these things that Rich found while he's researching serial killers, and the little things about luring and what they do, and all of that comes to life visually. So I'm curious.
Well, thank you.
Once you had this script in hand, did you immediately start plotting and planning your visuals? Did you work on your casting first? What was your next step in this process?
Yeah, by the way, well said. And, you know, I can use you to come pitch any one of our scripts next, by the way. I'm hiring
happy,
you.
Happy.
Well
happy
done.
To do
well,
it.
Well said.
So.
But, the connection's a little bad. So the one thing about the script too, just to finish, as he was writing the screenplay, he was about 3/4 through it, and he texts me and he calls me and he's like, "Look, man, I haven't chosen who the killer is going to be yet." And so, I mean, it was amazing. So, and you can really feel it in the movie because he's like, "Look, I try to like purposely make you think it's this person, and then we go to this person." And, you know, it's so open to gender, everything. We don't know who it is. And it really, that's, I think, why it also really helped, because even the writer had not decided who the killer was going to be to the very end, which was great. But so the process after the screenplay was locked in, you know, I was like, at first I'm like, I have to really produce this. I love this movie. Let's get it made. And then, you know, after kind of COVID hit and slowed things down, we kept pushing it. And then a perfect storm happened when one of my fellow producers, who he's an amazing human being, Edward Osipov, he's like, "Look, I've done a movie with Terrence Howard before. He's looking for something like this. So I'm going to send it to him." I said, "Great, please do." And he sent it over, and that's kind of how it all started. And during this time we were in the SAG strike.
Oh, God.
So we really hit, yeah, that too. But luckily, we were an independent company, and we were independently financed. So we had the luxury of SAG, you know, they're supporting filmmakers still during this and wanting their actors to work, but they wanted to make sure they got their point across. And I was in the Screen Actors Guild myself, so big fan of SAG. So I was very happy that they gave us a waiver and allowed us to make this film. And that also allowed us with the cast to get certain people available at the same time that normally would be on a show or something else. So we got very lucky with that, and crew, and a lot of different people, and our colorist that's like top of the line, and our composer, who I've worked with many, many times as well. It's like him and Rich seem to be like my partners in crime. Josh Ashley, he's phenomenal. He's like my Trent Reznor. So yeah, we've got a great team, and I'm happy to answer any more questions as well. But I think that kind of steered you into how this thing kind of got going, and it got started up in the summer of last year, by the way.
Wow. Well, I have to say, your cast is great. You've got Terrence Howard, Isai Morales. I mean, he is a scene stealer. I have to say it. He really,
he's a maniac. He's amazing.
That's it. Maniac is the word. As a detective, as you know, the partner of Terrence Howard's character, the two of them play off of each other so well. But Isai, he goes out there. He gets snarky. He gets flippant.
Yeah.
And
he's the single bachelor.
Yeah.
He's the guy that never grew up. He wants to be the playboy. And then the counter opposite is his partner, Brian Sutter, which is Terrence Howard, who's a married man, you know, with his family. And, you know, each one of these characters in the film have their own personal demons they're dealing with, which all people do, right? So we have a lot of relatable sides to that. And within the story, we have essentially the battle between good versus evil, the Catholic Church against the Satanic Church, the battle in faith, this small town being ravaged by the serial killer. And you see it in the movie. You can feel that the faith in this town is being lost. So there's a lot of these little hidden kind of storylines that we threw in just to kind of add to the elements of the movie.
Well, and you bring in an outsider, you bring in Nikki Whelan's character, who gets thrown into the investigation along with the boys. And that kind of upsets the apple cart because we find out things about her as we move along that puts a skew on how things are perceived. Alec Baldwin is rock solid as the police chief of detectives. He is wonderful. But even the way Alec plays his character, you're wondering, does he know something he's not saying?
I agree. I totally agree. And yeah, like you said, Alec, his presence alone, I mean, he's just so commanding.
Yes.
And then when we're sitting in a scene here and we're shooting the police detective room, when we have Alec, Isai, Terrence, and Nikki, I mean, you got two, you know, Oscar nominated actors in the scene.
Yeah.
And all their personalities, they just loved working off each other. They had so much fun. And it was really great to watch and also be a part of. And we collaborated really well. And I'll be honest, you know, some movie sets, you kind of see the actors getting along better than others. And some will all go out to dinner together and some won't on their off days. But everybody came to the dinners. We all got along really well. They all supported the story and our vision. Because when I say our vision, it's not just mine. It's everyone's. You know, it's a team of us together that really did this film. From our producers to our writer. And our actors really bring... You know, they brought those characters to life even better than I could have imagined.
You know, because they were working so closely and collaborating and got along so well, how much freedom did they have to ad lib? You've got Alec, especially, with what he brings to characters, and he's so introspective when he thinks about his character before he opens his mouth, and how he can bring that character to life. And it might not necessarily be what somebody had on a page, but his instincts are incredible. So I'm curious how much freedom you gave your actors to ad lib.
I mean, yeah. Great question, by the way. And yes, I was a child actor myself. And so I really approach it as an actor's director, the way I give my actors the freedom. Because like I said, the script is the blueprint. We know what story we want to tell. But they're going to bring their perspective and their take to each moment. And I just feel like doing that, just giving the freedom, even if they stick to the script or not, you know, there's going to be moments where they're going to bring something that's completely different that we didn't expect that just blows our minds. And there were many moments within this film that happened. We ended up even changing a few scenes just by when we were blocking, rehearsing. We were talking about it and just new things came to life, which were phenomenal. So I really give the actors the freedom to bring it. And, you know, we'll try it. And if it doesn't work, you know, we'll go back to a take with the script. And it's kind of what I learned from working on comedies. There was a lot more riffing in comedy than anything else and improvising. And so that kind of helped me kind of prepare for this even, because we were completely open. And like you said, with this cast, I mean, why wouldn't we want them to bring it? And they did. Believe me, they did.
And of course, you give us a really good look at an up-and-comer, Weston Cage, and he even got to write a song for the film.
Yes, Weston Cage is amazing. He really brought it. He went there. I mean, this guy, his songs in the movie, his character is very hardcore.
Yes.
And it was really fun to work with him. I had also got, you know, was blessed to produce a film with his father years back, Grand Isle, another thriller. And so there were so many things that I saw within him that his father does, and it's phenomenal. But he has his own, you know, his own style and his own way. But I will say it was pretty cool, and what a great human being. The guy has a lot of heart. He's the biggest, strong, sweetest guy you'll ever meet, and he can do death metal, and his emotions can go all the way up and down, and he was just fun to work with.
And I love the vulnerability that he brought to the role. Because when things start, you know, everything starts falling apart, feels like walls are closing in, you know, a lot of the bravado goes away, and there's this vulnerability of what? You think I did it? No, I didn't do it. And you see his eyes get wide, and he truly is shell-shocked. And I love the range that he gives us. I did not expect that. And I'm very...
Well, thank you. Even me, I was very happy with what he brought to the table on this. And, you know, one of the scenes... It's funny, because I like to push our actors far.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the scenes, we pushed really hard, and he went so far with it, and I loved it. But even in the edit, we had to kind of tone it down just for the story point.
Wow.
But, I mean, he has the levels. He's phenomenal. And he's definitely a force to be reckoned with, and love to work with him anytime.
Yes.
And that says there's more of the people on this cast that I can't even say that about as well, but I'll let you ask your questions first.
But I mean, Weston, obviously watching him here, it is very, and he's done a couple other things, but not to this degree. The apple did not fall far from the tree with
yes,
Weston.
I completely agree.
But now you've got this great cast in play. They're playing around, they're working, they're collaborating. But now it falls on your visuals and the work with your cinematographer, with Alex Salahi. I got to tell you, RJ, the film is polished. I love the color saturation. I love the color, period, and how you play with that. The lighting really works so well in those pool scenes, indoor pool scenes. Absolutely stunning. Camera dutching and framing, you and Alex play with that. Talk to me about designing your visual grammar with Alex and how you implemented that to fuel this story.
Yeah, thank you. No, and I'll tell you another thing is it's the lenses and the cameras and everything, all of the above with Alex Law. He's amazing.
What lenses?
So, yeah,
What lenses were you shooting with?
So basically, since the SAG strike was happening and a lot of the big budget studio films weren't going on, we got the luxury of using the Hawk Anamorphics, which are the Ferrari of lenses, everybody.
Oh my God.
I'm telling you, this small budget indie film, there's a reason why it looks like it was done for a lot more. And that's where I'm going to give kudos to my director of photography and our production designer and everyone else. But we had. We use the Arri Alexa LF, the 35, the new Alexa. We had the best lenses. Our DP is phenomenal, Alex Lai. He worked underneath a guy, you know, that might have DP'd Pulp Fiction and other films. Small guy. I'm just kidding. So anyway, Alex, he's amazing. So what we did was in prep, we really talked about tones and colors. And another thing that we were very lucky to have was we went to Little Rock to shoot this film. And we only had, once we got our SAG waiver, we only had about once we got word we were approved, that was 2.5 weeks before our start date. So I had literally just flown in that day to Little Rock, and the film commissioner, Chris Crane, took me around and started showing me locations that day. It was amazing. And so the locations of Little Rock really, really, they were the film. It was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. So we checked every location. We text scouted. We talked about lighting, tones, colors, feels, angles. of how he wanted to, you know, tell this story. And I'll really leave that to Alex, because the director of photography, I mean, I'm the director, right? I'm storytelling, performances, everything else, script stuff. But the director of photography, I give kudos to Alex. He made this movie look beautiful, and he always knew where to put the camera. And, you know, there's a couple ideas I've thrown here and there, but I was very blessed to have his skills on this film. And you can see it. It looks, like you said, top of the line. It's great. And the colors we use that normally wouldn't be available, that those Star Wars and many huge films, we had him to color our film. It was just a great ensemble of top of the line people that really helped this thing come to life.
And look at that. The strike worked in your favor.
It sure did. And I'll tell you, the other part of this, Sugar Studios came in and really did a great job on the sound and the design. And meant that, you know, the sound design in this film is something that you don't even necessarily pay attention to, but you hear it and you know, wow, like there's so many little things that we throw into it that you'll kind of notice after I kind of talk about it. But I'm going to wait for you all to watch it, and then we can, you know, people can ask more questions about it later. And then, like I said, my composer, Josh Atchley, he's phenomenal. He worked for Hans Zimmer's company for 5+ years. I mean, the guy's a genius.
What?
So I'm really pleased with how this all turned out.
So let me jump ahead to the music, since you brought up Josh again. What were you looking for musically to complement and serve as an undercurrent for Crescent City, rather than the music leading us? Because it doesn't. It's not telling us, uh-oh, something's coming. We don't get any of that. You let the story do that. You let the performances do that. You let the physical expressiveness of the actors do that. Your score is an undercurrent, but it buttresses the tone of the film. So I'm curious what you were looking for musically from Josh.
I mean, just what you just said. I mean, literally, Josh, he's a type of composer who doesn't like to be, I call it Captain Obvious, where you're hitting that moment with the score right at that beat. Like, he hates doing that. He likes to be creative and bring the sounds and just to give you that emotion, but not push you into it. Let the performance do it for you, and then he complements it with it, like you just said. And that's why he's so talented and good, because a lot of composers would, that are newer, or, you know, don't, are kind of finding their way, mm-hmm. they would kind of do a little bit more of the obvious ding, yeah. tings, and booms, and all that kind of stuff. And Josh, he just really knew how to play into each moment. And I've never seen a composer, when we're doing the sound mix, even say, yeah, take out the score there. We don't need it here. Like that. It's like, that's what shows his confidence in his work. Mm-hmm. And it was great. So, and then musically, we had BMG really supporting us with some of their artists and music. Mm-hmm. So we had great songs. And one thing about our killer, he or she, or they, them, whatever you want to call it, they were influenced by the way they set up their parties and their music and their pool and their mannequins. And a little thing about mannequins, by the way, I was terrified of mannequins. Going shopping with my mother, I was scared at Robinson's Mayor. I think it was like JCPenney when I was a kid. I can't remember. But I was terrified to go through because the mannequins freaked me out. Because when I got lost in a department store as a kid, and I ran up and I thought my mom was the mannequin, and I went up and I grabbed and it looked up and there was no face. It just freaked me out. Twilight Zone as a kid. So anyway, that all freaked me out. And when I found out that this serial killer used mannequins as kind of like a prop for their parties and everything, it was so creepy, and we had to use it in the film. And yeah, that's another little additive thing that I have my own demons to deal with that when I look at those mannequins.
Well, mannequins can be very creepy. Trust me, mannequins today don't look as terrifying as mannequins from years ago looked. Mannequins today seem to have some more personality, or else they're totally blank. But years
they
ago,
sure do.
Boy, when I was growing up and I'd see mannequins in the store, they were pretty scary. You know, back in the 60s, number one, they were really ugly mannequins. They didn't have any movable...
Yeah, they were.
No movable parts at all. It's like they came out of the factory and, okay, they stick in each arm and they're bent and they stay bent and you can't do anything with them. So I thought it was really interesting with all of the mannequins that are brought in to the storyline in Crescent City. But what also was very interesting are the costumes, the wardrobe that was put on the mannequins.
Yes. I'm glad you noticed that.
That was... It's like, oh my God, how many Goodwill stores did you go to find some of those things that are like Studio 54 level but disheveled?
So the wardrobe costume designer, Meg, who's phenomenal, she's a local Little Rock resident, she found all these fantastic vintage places out there outside of Little Rock, and it was really important for us to design this because the backstory is the father of the killer was a clothing designer, and so the collection over the years was passed down to them. So mm-hmm. I'm trying to really not give away
we're not doing spoilers. No spoilers here.
Yeah, no. But yeah, so that's where that was all influenced. And so the songs being played and the party scenes with the mannequins, all of that was very, very, very well selected. And we took a lot of attention to detail on those moments.
Yeah, and I have to say the needle drops there are really wonderful. Very apropos and fitting. If people listen to the lyrics, it really does add even more to some of those sequences. Especially the mannequin sequences. You've got so many elements packed in here, RJ, that all just come together in this beautiful package. Now, a big, big element with any film, as you know, is the editing. You've got Eric Potter. I'm a fan of Eric's work. Paradise Cove he did, Pay Dirt, which I love, Vatican Tapes. So you've got somebody that really understands building tension, thriller-esque editing.
Wow. Yes, I mean, you forgot Underworld, which is one of my favorite
movies. Yes, Underworld, yes. The Lycans.
He is phenomenal. And that's why he was really great for this tone as well, Eric Potter, just from his experience. And, you know, there's two movies you make, right? There's a movie you make in principle when you're shooting it, mm-hmm. right? And then there's the movie you make in post.
Yep.
And they can change. But they always change, I think, for the better. And Eric Potter was phenomenal. He and I were so much kind of in sync on so many different things that even his assembly and part of his cut that he did before I started digging in, there was just so much of it that I had already kind of picked from my shots. And so mm-hmm. he and I, it was like a dream working with Eric Potter.
How difficult was it to find the tone without being a revealing or revelatory tone so that you keep building to the final aha? And I mean mm-hmm. final after, okay, maybe this, oh my God. That's tricky. That's very tricky. So I'm curious about the challenges the two of you had in finding the tone and building this tension so consistently.
Well, thank you on the tone. Now it's very tricky to kind of really nail that in a story all the way through. I think the way we approached it was very practical and grounded and raw. So the performances and just the story itself, and we gave, like I said, kudos to the writer for even writing it that way. Mm-hmm. We definitely all talked about it. And I think it's just, like you said, the talent really kind of grasped the story and everybody just kind of stayed in their lane and did their thing. And luckily it worked really well on this film. And, you're going to see it in the performance. They really stay true to their character.
Yeah.
And that's when you're dealing with phenomenal actors. That's why for me, you know, I know what I'm getting once I'm casting the actor. I'm not an over technical director. I give a lot of freedom to my actors once I cast them. Mm-hmm. And then if things are, you know, a little off or we want to try something else, we'll always do an adjustment. But that, you know, the freedom we give them in this case really worked out well, too. And, you know, even Michael Ciro, who played Pastor Lawson, thought he did a phenomenal job.
Yeah.
You know, Rose Lane playing Sabrina Harris was great. Maria, I mean, everyone in the entire cast was great. So it was a lot of fun to work with everybody. And we had a cameo from our actor producer, Vince Jolovit. He's awesome. So even he popped in the film.
So, you know, I've got to ask you, what is the appeal of these crime movies, of detective-style movies for you, because in addition to Crescent City, which in theaters and on digital and on demand this Thursday, or the 16th, which is Friday, you've also got out right now, as a producer, Boneyard, which I love, and The Girl in the Pool, which actually, parts of that, it's just, it's funny to watch the paranoia that plays out.
I mean, the man is falling apart, and everything is coming in, it's full circle, and karma is just about to pound down on this guy on his birthday party, and it's such a great story, and it's so fun to watch, and, you know, Freddie was such a pro, and so great to, I mean, just the everyone in the audience watching him go through this, you just can't help but laugh through part of it, because it's just like, there's so much going on, and the characters around him, and Michael Cera was in that film as well, and he was so great as his, like, kind of drunk buddy trying to get him all hyped up and party. And there's just a lot of comedy relief within the seriousness of the film. So that was a lot of fun. And, yeah, we I'm blessed to have a good network of producers that we work with. And we do, you know, a fair amount of films. And we have some really big stuff coming up next as well. But, yeah, thank you. I mean, we've just been blessed to have a lot of things moving forward.
Well, and, of course, some of the best scenes in The Girl in the Pool are Freddie playing opposite Kevin Pollak. The father-in-law, son-in-law scene, sitting there off to the side of the house on top of the pool storage facility is to die for. That is to die for, RJ.
Kevin Pollak, man, yes, he just was amazing in this film, and he's so much fun to watch work. I mean, that guy's body, it's like Alec, you know, like those two guys are very similar. They're just pros, and it's so real, too. Like, we all have those in-laws or know people have the in-laws that are just, they just really can't, you just can't get along, and so it's so fun to watch, because it's just truth. It's being truth told.
But just, I mean, it's so funny. But then Boneyard, which, as I am such a fan of that film and what Asif did with that. Here again, it's a film very similar to Crescent City in that everybody has baggage. Our main, we've got serial killings happening there. I don't know what this is with you and serial killers.
You know, it's funny. Let me just kind of stop you right there. I know where you're going with that. I'm a rom-com comedy, action comedy person that just happens to get thrown into these great thrillers sometimes. But I have a very big variety of movies that we do.
I know.
And just to make you feel better, I'm doing a massive rom-com for the Philippines next year, early next year. And it's like a Crazy Rich Asians for the Philippines, and everybody will see that and enjoy it. So,
oh, my God. Yeah. But it's you, as a producer, as a director, you have a great handle on story structure, on bringing it to life, on melding your story with your visuals, building your visuals, and having your team build the visuals so it's a complete story. That's what you did with Boneyard, with the ambiguity you create. Crescent City, ambiguity abounds between our major players. You know, everybody is a suspect, and there are reasons for that. Boneyard, everybody is a suspect. There are reasons for that. All the way to Mel Gibson.
Yeah, and both based after true stories, by the way, true events.
Yeah, I mean, I'm waiting. I know Asif is working on a documentary or a true story based on the West Mesa murders. So I'm curious to see what he comes up with for that. But these films are they're riveting, but they're also so well crafted. This is one of your gifts, RJ. Is you craft really good films. They're not schlock.
I really appreciate that.
They're not thrown together. There is so much thought, and all that thought, be it as a producer, as a director, working with Rich, having that collaborative familiarity, there is thought and care put into everything, and everything that I see on screen in your films is purposeful. There's a reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason for certain color. There's a reason for color saturation. There's a reason for having the shed lit very darkly in the back so that you just see one little thing in the front of it when you open the door. And I love films that are this well-crafted with this much thought. You have done another amazing job with Crescent City.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for your kind words, really. I mean, I'll tell you, it's been a long time coming, I'll tell you. You know, from a child actor, when, you know, it's really hard to break through when you're a kid, and then to going behind the scenes at 21 and deciding to make your own destiny, and then starting to produce and cast and put stories together, you know, now I'm a lot older, and I've really just kind of figured out what really works for us. And I love storytelling, and I'll do it till the day I die. And it's just, it's a blessing. It doesn't feel like work for 1 minute. So thank you for saying that, because it's been a long, long road of this. And, we have some amazing stuff coming up, and a lot less serial killer thrillers next. So,
but that's okay.
We'll keep you posted on the next ones.
Hey, I like rom-coms. I like docs. I like serial killers. There's no genre that I don't like and appreciate. But I am very partial to thrillers.
So am I. Can you tell? No,
it's so funny when you mentioned at the top of, you know, how Rich had not even written. He was only three quarters through and he didn't even know who the killer was going to be. And it just made me think of a Murder, She Wrote episode that just re-ran again last week. Because I have that on during the night on the TV as background noise. And I think I know the dialogue to every Murder, She Wrote ever done. I've seen them so many times, but
I watched them. I love that series.
Oh, well, and in this particular episode, Jessica's working on her book and she's stuck and she goes, I haven't figured out who the killer is yet. And that's where my mind went when you told me that about Rich in the script. So it's just, I love your work. I love this film. I can't encourage people high enough to see it in a theater, see it sitting in the comfort of your own home, digitally, on demand. It is well worth it, and they will be riveted to the screen. And just when you think you know what's happened, go back to square one, because you don't. and that's the best kind of film. Best kind. RJ,
I completely agree. Thank you.
This has been so fabulous having you on the show, talking about Crescent City and a few other of your little gems. I hope you'll come back on the show. I can't wait to see this big, big rom-com thing you're doing. Any idea when the next film will be out?
Well, we did another couple films already that I'm kind of keep kind of low key for the moment.
Okay.
But there is a film that I am casting right now that I'm directing that is very much a No Country for Old Men meets Man on Fire. That's all I can say for now. It's phenomenal.
Wow.
It's kind of basically just a true element as well, about a father that would do anything for his daughter. And the world, no matter how much you're trying to protect his daughter, the world is going to come back and get you. So they have to deal with that. And I'll give you a little teaser. The name is called Mermaid.
Oh, my.
It's phenomenal. So that will be hopefully shooting either by the end of the year or early next year after the big romantic comedy in the Philippines.
Oh, my God. Oh, well, I can't.
And there might be one actor that you just talked about that we're trying to get to play the father. So we'll see if we get him.
And I'm pretty sure I know who that is.
Well, let's not tell the audience yet.
Nope, we're not going to. Nope, but I'm pretty sure I know who that may be. If you can work it around his schedule. RJ, this has been spectacular. I sincerely hope we get to talk again in the future. Come back on the show anytime, and even if it's not on the live show, you know, off-camera, phone interviews, whatever. I'm just so looking forward to what you bring us next.
Well, thank you, and I'm in. Anytime with you, I would love to speak to you and your audience. So thank you so much. And, Crescent City, coming shortly. And, you know, if you will want to keep up with any updated information that comes out, I'm not a big social media person, but I'm, you know, I have an Instagram page called @DirectorRJC that will have stuff up there for people to follow what happens next.
Is there, I didn't see it because it's a Lionsgate release. Is there a website page for Crescent City?
You know, it's funny. We never did it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was looking for one and I thought, okay, maybe it's buried somewhere. But all right, so I'm not imagining
it. Website.
Well, then people are going to have to find you on Instagram to get tidbits.
Yes, and
updates.
Like you said, this Friday, Crescent City is coming out everywhere. So I can't wait for people to watch it and enjoy the ride.
Oh, RJ, thank you, thank you. You go have a wonderful rest of your day.
Well, thank you so much. You too.
Bye bye.
All right, bye.
And that was RJ Collins, director of Crescent City, out on all the platforms, day, date, all around, this Friday. I think you're going to love it. It's so well done. It's riveting. The story is riveting. Great cast with Terrence Howard, Isai Morales, Nikki Whelan, Alec Baldwin, Weston Cage. Check it out. It's great. As I said, okay, now, next week, I have no clue what we're doing. Either we're going to have a person, if I get confirmation, or you're going to be hearing my interviews with Emmy nominees. So, until then, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.